Today is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. This is part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Peter spells his last name H-U-N-T-O-O-N. My name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Peter. How are you today?
Good.
Great. Peter, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Yesterday, you mentioned more of your studies on the west end of the faulting that was out there and the basalts, the volcanics going on. And once you wrapped up that Western Grand Canyon mapping project, where did you go from there?
Well, the next stop for us was to move up to Canyonlands National Park.
And how did that happen?
Well, that was another thing that just came along, and I'll tell you about that. Before we leave the Grand Canyon, though, there's actually a rather important thing to say.
Okay.
Up until this point, our conversation about all this has been pretty cavalier, you know. We've looked at the fun and games of being a young guy running around in the wilderness out there and getting on the river and all the thrills associated with that.
Yeah.
But a perspective that I have to provide is that the Grand Canyon is really tough. And the problem is, it's the inverted mountain. Mm. Generally, what you do is you're on a mountain, as you're climbing it, you get tired, and you're able to walk off it.
Yes.
In the Grand Canyon, you climb down it, and then you got to get out of it when you're tired.
Right.
And everything is against you.
Yes.
And the way I've looked at the Grand Canyon is as soon as you step off the rim, the Grand Canyon is there to test to see if you have the stuff it takes to earn your right to be there.
Mm.
And this is something that is very important, because what the Grand Canyon is going to do is it's going to take somebody like me, who knew very little about it, and it's going to temper me, and it's going to prepare you, and that's really important.
Can you expand on that?
Well, you know, I was born in New Jersey, and of course, what I got to do is see pictures of the Grand Canyon. I was absolutely in awe of the scenery, and I had no idea that this thing had such a draw on me, and that I was going to ultimately get to it, and then it was going to consume me for the entire rest of my career.
Mm.
And this happened stepwise, and like all things in life, it develops, and before you know it, you're caught up in it, and it's part of you. And I just happened to be in the right place at the right time to get started with these fellows mapping the Grand Canyon. And, yeah, we had a lot of fun and games, but the Grand Canyon can deliver up its hardships as well. And during this period, it really did work us over, but we started to understand a lot more. And the important thing is that we were young when we started this thing.
Yes.
I was in my 20s, so was George. And so we were newbies. And here we are, faced with mapping a Grand Canyon, not exactly the smallest thing in the world. And we started in it almost without realizing, you know, the dimensions of what we were getting into.
Mm.
Now, the thing that was important is that by working there, it really honed our skills, obviously. And it educated us.
Yes.
And it broadened our geologic horizons, because we were learning so much about so many different aspects of geology doing this job that we'd only seen, you know, in textbooks or heard about in classrooms. So this was really an important thing. For me, it also delivered up the pain of losing my wife in 1970.
Yes.
And what I really felt bad about that is that Sue really got a raw deal, and the raw deal is that she had seen me through all my college years, supported me for all that stuff, starved with me for 6 years, and then right at the time when I get the darn degree, she dies. She never got to enjoy any of the benefits that would come from just getting into the middle class, let alone anything else with me. Mm. And that just, you know, that was just tragic. And that was, of course, hanging over it. And the way it was. The project really matured all of us. Everybody that was involved came out the other end with a lot better skills, with a lot better perspective on geology, and it made us ready for what was going to come. It forced us to grow, and it gave us some competence. And that's the important point that I want to make. Another thing about it is that it was one of those things where we gathered together a group of people, and they turned out to be the right people at the right time to seize this moment in history and get the job done.
Wow!
And this is really important. This is certainly trivial in comparison to an analogy, but it's like at the beginning of World War II, you had FDR and Churchill in both countries, absolutely the right men to handle the job that came along, and they got it done.
Yeah.
And there's a bit of this in this Grand Canyon project. Now what we're going to do is we're going to graduate, and we're going to get associated with the Canyonlands Natural History Association and go up and map canyonlands. Okay.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah.
Before you leave this concept of being tempered, gaining confidence and growing that working in the Grand Canyon region gave you, when you came away, I just want to clarify this because I think it's incredibly important. When you came away from the Grand Canyon, did you actually have a sense of, wow, I did that? That's totally impossible. I mean, if you'd have talked to me when I was in high school, I'd have laughed you across the street because it was totally impossible. But I did it. We did it. Did that confidence then carry you forward throughout your career? I think your answer is kind of yes, it did.
That's exactly what happened. But you know, you're not aware of that when it's happening.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not that egotistical. I'm not sitting there saying, "Hey, we did something great." All we did was we finished a job. But what it prepared us to do is, all of a sudden, we had that under our belts, and we started to learn that Canyonlands had the same opportunity, and Bill Breed had been talking to somebody up there, and they'd expressed some nominal interest in it, so we were ready to talk to them. And the big deal is that what we were, of course, I was employed by then. I was working at the University of Nebraska, so I already had a job. That wasn't the problem. The deal was, we're looking at Canyonlands, which is almost as big, and all that needed to be done was to say yes. But we knew nothing about Canyonlands.
Okay.
And so that was the thrill. It was like when we moved into the Western Grand Canyon. It was going to be all new to us. But now we, without being real cognizant of it, we had the confidence to say, sure, let's go for it.
Got it.
And that's what happened. Now, what happens is, professionally for me, I'm talking about me now, there's going to be three of us involved in Canyonlands. It's going to be George Billingsley doing the stratigraphy, me doing the structure, same as in the Grand Canyon, and Bill Breed helping us secure the funds, and he also picked the color code for Canyon.
Cool.
But Bill was really acting in a liaison capacity and putting the resources of the Museum of Northern Arizona and its prestige on the line to get this contract. Now, the people that are going to fund it are the Canyonlands Natural History Association, and they're going to do just what the Grand Canyon Natural History Association and the Lake Mead Natural History Association did, they're going to feed us a minimal amount just to keep us in food to get the job done.
Okay.
But this is the deal. But for me professionally, when we get to Canyonlands, this is one of these places where, for me, the rubber hits the road. And I think you'll find that as we develop our story as we go forward.
Okay, all right.
Okay. Are we
so,
sort of there?
No, this is excellent. So how did the first whiff of Canyonlands come up?
Well, I really don't know. All of a sudden, I knew we were there, and we were meeting with some park people.
So that makes me think that was Bill Breed, who would have...
Yeah, he found somebody that he talked to up there.
Okay.
And what we did is we arrived...
Had you been to Canyonlands before this? And we're talking about Island in the Sky and the Needles District and the Maze, the river down to the confluence of the Green and the Colorado and down through Cataract Canyon. Of course, that's Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. Canyonlands had just become a national park not too long before this time.
Yeah, that's right.
With much struggle for decades before that, going back to Roger Toll in the 1930s, to get that land into the national park system.
That's right, and we arrived when the second superintendent took the reins of the place.
Okay, so that's not Bates Wilson. That's the
No, Bates was already retired.
Okay.
The guy that was there was a fellow named Pete Perry.
Okay.
And he was at the park from 1975 to 1987.
All right.
And he was another one of these guys that was absolutely the right person at the right time.
Oh, wow.
Without him, the park would not be what it is today.
Wow.
And this is important. And you can Google this guy and read obituaries about him, and they're true right down to the last word. But at any rate, what happened was, we, of course, meet Pete, and he's very enthusiastic. This guy is a real progressive, and what he's trying to do is manage a park, and what he wants is some science to back him up.
Okay.
So this map sounds like just what he wants.
Okay.
So he gets enthusiastic. The Natural History Association gets involved. They're a sidearm. And they fund it, and this guy has got this project going. Okay, this is in the early 70s.
Okay.
And, this is all good. All he's doing is looking at the map is a potential resource tool.
Okay.
You know, his knowledge of the geology is peripheral, but it's of interest. But the primary thing he's looking at is this thing going to be a resource for him. And that turns out to be true. Now, our role... We come in, and we're going to be these scientists that put this little map together for them, and we're going to serve as objective, unbiased geologic experts putting this stuff on paper. And if they're interested, they can ask us for technical advice, but we don't have any particular stake in this game, like, we're not environmentalists, we're not oil guys, we're not uranium guys. You know, we're just putting stuff on paper that they can use.
Right. You're a professor now at the University of Nebraska in the hydrology department.
Yeah, in geology.
In geology, okay. And George is working for the USGS now?
No, he's still, he's just about, I don't know if he's working for him yet or not, but he was either working for them or Grand Canyon Expeditions. He made that change just about that time.
Okay. Does he have his PhD by then?
No, he had a master's.
Master's with Stan Buse, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But the big deal with George was, he was good. He was a good stratigrapher.
Yeah.
And he was available.
Okay.
And, of course, we were already a team, and it was just natural to move forward. Now, as he's taken on this job, he's also starting to map around the Grand Canyon, and I've already mentioned that he covered a heck of a lot of ground down there. And so he's got a lot on his plate, too.
Okay.
But Canyonland's going to be our focus for the next couple of years.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Pete Perry arrives at the National Park at a critical period in its history. And there, the first thing he runs into is nothing but resistance from the local community.
Yep.
The local community had no use for the park. They wanted uranium mining on the park. They wanted to drill for oil on the park. They wanted to do everything there. They wanted to graze their cattle on the park.
Yep.
And here they are facing a national park, and they think they're going to be robbed of their livelihoods. They are not happy.
Right.
And this guy has got to navigate that. He's got every county commissioner in all the counties in the park and surrounding them that are adamantly opposed to him. Well, anyway, he was a calm, quiet, back-of-the-room type guy that just could take punch after punch and come out and move a progressive park vision forward and save the park. One of the ideas that had been floating around was that the National Park Service, up to this time from its inception, had two goals. One is to preserve beautiful areas, and the other was to make them open to access by the public.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the way the parks were developing, access turned out to be the number one priority.
Yes.
And there are good examples. Let me give you two of them. One of them is in Glacier National Park. They built the island, the Skyline Drive that goes up through Glacier.
Yes.
And that was an amazing engineering feat to take this road over the mountain.
Yes.
And what they did is put a road right through the most beautiful part of the park.
Yep.
Which sounds like an environmental disaster. Another place that they did the same thing was in Zion. They put a road right through Zion, which meant digging a tunnel that was, over a mile long through there.
Yep.
To get them up through the grades. And you couldn't do that today if you had to. But anyway, the emphasis is on, access.
Yes.
Well, when Perry takes over the Canyonlands, what he's looking at is a national park-sponsored proposal to build a highway that goes from somewhere around Moab right across the park, and it goes all the way down to the Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow.
Right through all the Red Rock country.
Whoa.
Of southern Utah. I mean, this thing is on the drawing board.
This is the county commissioners wanting to do this.
Yeah, they want to do it, but the park system wanted to do it.
Oh, interesting.
So anyway, over the years, he nibbles away at that until it finally goes away, and thank God for that. Now, what he was dealing with, he had a park that was brand new, and most of the access out there was dirt roads.
Yep.
And they're asking him to get highways out there. And what he starts doing is he starts answering a challenge by building some modest paved roads out there, like on the island in the sky. But he's not interested in putting a freeway through there, let me tell you.
Right.
So anyway, this is the first thing that comes down the pike. No sooner than he's dealing with that, and I mean he's in the throes of this, and he's gaining the respect of the people that hate him, they develop more mature relationships, and they just agree to disagree.
Yeah.
And everybody comes out as a winner now, but, you can't see that when you're
looking ahead. That's right.
But now the big deal is, the thing that falls in next is the Department of Defense is looking for a high-level nuclear waste disposal facility.
Now, when did you become aware of that?
Well, I didn't become aware of that for a few years after we started the project.
Okay, so hold that thought yet. Let's just keep that in abeyance for a minute here. And let's take it step by step. Your first visit with Pete Perry, what were your impressions? Met this guy? Did you meet him with George and Bill?
I'll tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I probably met this guy and talked to him maybe three or four times in my life.
All right.
And probably the longest conversation I ever had with him was about a half an hour.
Okay.
I didn't know him. All I knew was he was obviously a good man.
Yep.
But he was the kind of guy that could delegate.
Okay.
And once he made a, passed on this idea, this map, he delegated the oversight of it from the park's perspective to his chief naturalist, who was a guy named Dave May.
Okay.
So Dave served as the liaison between me and George, and the park for the rest of the project.
What do you remember about Dave? When did you first meet him? What was he like?
Well, I met him right away, and he was a very affable guy. He wasn't a geologist. He was very enthusiastic about the project, and he was like Bill Breed. He was simply saw his role as a facilitator to get this thing rolling because the boss wanted it, and he made the resources we needed available to us, which was this. He helped with the money with the national park association up there, and he helped us get permits.
Okay,
and so getting permits to run down through Cataract with the rafts was no problem.
Okay,
and those and were. That was really valuable.
Those were, again, administrative use permits?
Yeah, okay. They had to be.
Uh-huh.
And so it was the kind of thing where I could call them up and have a permit the next week.
Wow.
You know, I mean, we didn't take advantage of
it. No.
Run a lot of trips down there, but we sure ran trips down there.
Yeah.
Now, Canyonland was also more amenable to working from the river than the Grand Canyon because it's not quite as deep. And so we got an awful lot of work done from the river. Whereas we were pounding the plateaus just like we did at the Grand Canyon, but we were also getting an awful lot off the river a lot easier than we could do in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
So this is where the thing really gets interesting. Now about the Canyonlands. The thing that made Canyonlands is part of the Colorado Plateau, just like the Grand Canyon is in the Colorado Plateau. The one big distinction at Canyonlands was there's a thing called the Paradox Formation that lies between about 2,000 feet below the land surface in the low parts of the park to a mile below the land surface in the high parts of the park up to the north. And the Paradox Formation is 85% pure salt, sodium chloride, the stuff that comes out of your salt shaker.
How did that form?
Well, there was a thing called the Paradox Basin back in Pennsylvanian time.
Okay.
We're talking about, 320 million years ago or something like that.
Yep.
Anyway, there was this Paradox Basin, which was adjacent to what was then the Proto-Pacific Ocean, and there was a gap between the two, and once in a while the ocean would spill in and fill up the Paradox Basin, and then it would all evaporate.
Oh, interesting.
And
so it was a salt concentrator.
Yeah, it was just a pile of salt. And there were, like I say, there was salt under there. The salt under the park, that was the north end of the Paradox Basin. So as you went eastward, the salt got a little thinner. But anyway, there were places under the park where there was over 5,000 feet of this salt.
Holy cow!
And underneath the confluence between the Green and the Colorado Rivers, there was about 2,000 or 2,500 feet of salt there. Now, this stuff is 2,500 feet of sodium chloride. The sodium chloride is in big, thick beds, some of them more than 100 feet thick. And they're separated from each other by layers of silt and limestone and also potash. Now, if you look at it, the water spills into the Paradox Basin. It starts evaporating. The first thing that deposits is the limestone.
So these are freshwater limestones. Not freshwater.
Well, they got shells in them and everything.
Okay.
And then the next thing that comes out is the sodium chloride.
Okay.
And then the third thing that comes out is the potash, which is more soluble than sodium chloride. And this potash is so pure, they dig it up and they can use it for fertilizer. And then the next thing that comes out
Wait. The limestone I can understand because we have a very calm, fairly deep enough sea to have limestone environment, and then that keeps evaporating away, and you're left with an ever higher concentration of sodium chloride, of salt.
Right.
And then what is the potash connection? I don't get that.
Well, the potash is more soluble than salt.
Okay.
So it's the last thing that comes out as the ocean is evaporating.
Okay.
And so they got a potash layer down there that's maybe 80 to 120 feet thick, something like that. And it's a pure layer that's under the whole thing.
Okay.
And ultimately, an outfit called Texas Gulf Sulfur is going to dig a shaft down there,
right,
and start mining this stuff, and they're still mining it.
They're leaching it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, at first they go in and they make a room and pillar mine out of it. And
okay.
Then what they do is they flood that mine, and now they pump the brine out and let that evaporate on the surface, and they don't have to haul the stuff out.
Got
it. So this is a very interesting operation. But anyway, besides worrying about that, okay, then the last layer is some silt blows in or washes in from the surrounding mountains, like
okay.
the Uncompahgre uplift, and they cover this mess with a layer of sediment, and that turns out to be these sandstone or shale layers.
Okay.
So you have this sequence of these salts and clastic layers sitting on top of each other, and they pile up, like I say, in some places over 5,000 feet underneath the park.
Okay.
Okay, now...
When did you figure all this out? I mean, some of this geology would have worked out before you, because there had been oil drillers out there, and they would have... The Paradox Dome, what's the name of that down there, some of this stuff would have been worked out before you guys showed up.
There'd been real good work done down there before we arrived.
Okay.
And now, you got to understand, we knew nothing about this stuff, so we get there.
Okay.
And we've got to learn all this stuff.
All right.
And that was the most thrilling part of my career, was to learn the dynamics of that.
Okay.
And what turned me on was that if you look at this pile of rocks, you got this Paradox salt in there, and the way to envision salt is not some hard rock. Think of it as a very viscous fluid.
Oh, wow.
So if we have this viscous fluid getting buried by progressively thicker sections of rock, and ultimately there's going to be 15,000 feet of rock up there, and when you count the whole Mesozoic section, that salt starts moving.
Ooh.
And it never stops.
Oh, wow.
So if you go into that country around Moab, what you see are these big, broad anticlines and synclines.
Yeah.
And the rivers are down in the synclines, eroding their way down. And those synclines and anticlines represent places where salt is flowed out from under the synclines and into the core to make the anticlines rise.
Oh, interesting.
So it's dynamic. And it's not deep-seated. We don't have to have faults going down to the mantle. This stuff is happening above the base of the Paradox. So we got three things that are going to go on that are really new to George and me.
Hmm.
One is this flowage of the salt that's going to form these big folds, and that's a dynamic process that's still going on.
Okay.
The folds are still forming, and they've been forming since Pennsylvanian time.
Oh, wow.
So this is dynamic. So what we look at when we look at a cross-section through canyon lands is we see radical thickening and thinning of our units that we're familiar with.
Hmm.
So you can take something like the Navajo sandstone, and you can find places in canyon lands where it's 20 feet thick, and 10 miles away, it's 500 feet thick.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's dramatic, you know. The other thing about it is that in some places, the salt dissolves. When it dissolves, it forms breccia pipes all the way up through the overlying rock.
Ooh.
As they collapse into the dissolution zone.
Okay.
So that's a very interesting aspect about the salt. So, and then the third thing about the salt is if you look at it, you got slabs of rock that are sitting on top of the salt, the upper layers of the Colorado Plateau there. And if they somehow get tilted, then those layers can slide on top of the salt.
Mm.
And guess what happens? What happens is, over time, we erode the canyon of the Colorado River through that section.
Okay.
And they cut down almost to the top of the salt. And as soon as they cut down to the salt, if those rocks are tilted towards the river, they start sliding towards the river. Okay, you've been down there. You've been through the big rapids that are in the lower part of Cataract Canyon.
Yeah.
Well, those rapids are about, I don't know, 13 or 15 miles long.
Mm-hmm.
It's a continuous set of rapids down there. They're the worst rapids on the Colorado River.
Right.
And what has happened is the land to the southeast dips towards the canyon there, and all the rocks from the crest of the anticline to the south, 20 miles south, are flowing on top of the salt, and they're impinging on the canyon. The canyon wall is closing vice-like across the river.
Oh, wow.
And as it does that, the rocks at the bottom of the river, on top of the Paradox salt, the thin layer of them that's left, they fold up and they rise into the river. And guess what's causing the rapids? The dynamics of that vice closing on the river even today.
Thank you. This is so helpful because when I go through there, I look at the geology and go, wow, this stuff is just fractured. I mean, it's like a boating through a gravel pit. You know, everything's just busted up and fallen in, and the river's trying to shunt it out as best as it can. But it, you know, it can only do so much. You got to have big rock falls come in there and make these big rapids again and again and again and again.
Yeah, well, just think of that. Now, as the southeast wall is moving into this, the river is eroding its base, right?
Yeah.
And you get collapse of the rocks off.
Yep.
And you got big boulders falling in there. And that's what you got at the big drops, is big boulders that have fallen off the Permian and landed in the middle of the river.
And it's very dynamic. I mean, just there'll be a flood, spring flood event will come through, and the rocks in those rapids change a little bit every now and then.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, it's wonderful. Now, what we found so much fun, when we were running the rapids through the canyon down there, when we'd get there in the spring, it would be after the flood, and all the wood debris from the winter floods would be on the beaches, right?
Okay. Yep.
And we'd be going down there, and what you'd see is rocks sitting on top of those.
Wow!
That's how fast this is happening. Now, I took a biologist down there one time, and he made the observation that the vegetation on the northwest side of the canyon was very mature compared to the vegetation on the southeast side.
Oh.
And the difference is that the northwest side is not falling into the river, so the trees and everything get to reach a mature stage.
Okay.
But the stuff on the southeast is getting taken out by landslides all the time, and it can't mature.
Okay.
Now tell me, is that a sexy observation, or is that a sexy observation?
That is very cool.
Yeah, that's neat. Now, we could go on forever about this. Now, another thing about this salt is that the salt can form what we call diapirs, and you get salt domes like they got in the middle of Texas that they drill through to get oil. And there's salt domes down there. And where we found the salt domes, and everybody else did, was down in the section with the rapids, where there's a very thin layer of rock left in the Paradox above the Paradox salts that's arching up. The salt diapirs pierce that in a couple of places.
Okay.
One is down at Cross Canyon, and I can't remember the second canyon. But anyway, they're beautiful salt domes, and these are salt plugs that are simply moving up. And that was all new to us. This was really dynamic.
So the salt domes, they're not like breccia pipes.
No, these are not. These are places where the salt is coming up. It just comes squirting up like you were squeezing a place.
I kind of think of the old lava lamp.
Yeah.
But in this case, it sounds like it's not like a big blob of stuff moving up, or is it?
Well, it's just like lava coming up, except it's salt.
But is it in cracks? Is it pushing up through fractures? Or
yeah,
it's
pushing up. It itself is pushing the rocks above it up.
So just making a dome of the rocks up above.
Like, yeah, it's just pushing up.
Okay.
Okay, now, we're talking about dynamic geology. It's happening now, and this is a little different than the Grand Canyon. In the Grand Canyon, we got active faults like the Hurricane and that stuff out to the west.
Right.
The but this is really active, and it's new when you can see it, you know.
Apart from the Grand Canyon faults, it seems very sleepy in comparison.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm used to the Grand Canyon. This is all new.
Oh, well.
I mean, all this is new, right?
Okay.
And I'm thrilled. Now, if you want to add icing to the cake, you know where the Island of the Sky District is between the Green and Colorado Rivers on the north end of the park.
Yes.
Dab smack in the Island in the Sky is a thing called Upheaval Dome.
Right.
Upheaval Dome, and this is no hyperbole, Upheaval Dome is the best exposed meteorite impact crater in the solar system.
Okay.
And the thing that makes it so perfect is, different than everything we see on the planets and different than all the other impact craters on the Earth, is that in the Island in the Sky, there are three canyons that cut across that thing and give us the best exposures you can see of a meteorite impact crater.
Wow.
The ones on the north and the south of it are shallow. They trend towards the west and discharge into the Green River. Mm-hmm. They're shallow canyons, but they give us profiles of the edge of the crater. And then right through the crater itself, a canyon heads and cuts down almost 2,000 feet and gives us a vertical profile right through the heart of the thing.
Wow.
There is nothing else like it on the Earth, and they've never spotted anything this good on the photos of the craters on the planets.
Cool.
So we got the best one, and it's right in the middle of Canyonlands.
Wow.
And this is, and, you know, George and I are looking at this. We really don't know what we're seeing. Well, of course, we map it. And we're confused. We don't know whether we're looking at a meteorite impact crater or a salt dome.
Right.
And it takes us, it takes me a couple of years to educate myself on these two kinds of craters until I realize that this thing is absolutely a classic meteorite impact crater. But before I finish that self-education, Eugene Shoemaker comes along, who was the world-renowned impact scientist in the USGS, and he drives into the park, and he looks at that thing, and he knew right at a glance that this was an impact crater.
Wow.
And so he had the vision on this thing even before I did, and we started discussing it, and I'm sitting there slapping up my forehead saying, of course, this is too good to be true.
Huh.
We got this thing, and it's right in our map.
What do you remember about Gene? First visit, first remembrances.
Well, Gene was a remarkable man. There's no question about it. He was absolutely brilliant, and he worked for the GS for his career.
Right.
And he became interested in these extraterrestrial bodies,
okay,
planets particularly. And if you're going to study them, it's all about impacts.
Hmm.
So he became a world-renowned impact specialist.
Okay.
And he was working for the USGS and Flagstaff in that complex they had, leading the impact studies.
Okay.
And so when they started the moon projects and they were sending guys up there, they were training all those guys in Flagstaff, and he was training them on how to observe the geology and report on it, because, of course, the astronauts were not geologists. They had to train them for that.
Right.
And so they brought all those guys into Flagstaff and all that. Now, Gene himself wanted to go to the moon, and he wanted to be involved in that kind of activity, but he had some kind of some subtle health problem that he shouldn't be in a rocket.
Huh.
He never went. And that was the great disappointment of his career. What happened was, Gene was studying, he'd go down to Australia and study impact craters on Australia, because that place is flat as a pancake, and there's several impact craters down there that are nicely preserved. And he was down there with his wife one time studying those impact craters, and they were driving this long straight road that had a turn in it. And he was a speed demon. Anyway, went around the curve and ran into another car and killed himself and injured his wife. Well, that was absolutely tragic. And that was really tragic. But what happened was, by then, he was such a formidable person in that game that they sent his ashes off to the moon.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, or off into space. I don't know if he went to the moon or if he just went out there, but they put him on a rocket and sent him out there.
Wow.
And, you know, what a fitting end.
Oh, touching. Time. Huh.
Yeah, that's pretty nice.
Wow.
But, Gene was a remarkable guy. And let me tell you a couple of things about him. We've talked about the symposiums that the Museum of Northern Arizona used to put on at the end of every summer.
Okay.
Gene would get to as many of those things as he could. And he would always come in there and give some dynamite presentation. And the first time that I ever heard about the Needles Fault Zone. This is that fault zone that produces the slide into the Cataract Canyon and gives us the rapids.
Okay.
The first time I heard about that was a presentation he gave that kind of outlined that gravity slide model.
Hmm.
And up until that time, other people had been mapping in there, but they didn't have it right. But, I'm listening to this talk, and I'm thinking, this guy really has this thing nailed.
Hmm.
And then a couple of years later, we got the contract to go map it. And so I always credit him with the concept, and that's only fair. But he was brilliant. He could see this stuff. He had that reputation through the whole GS. No matter where he was, he was doing state-of-the-art stuff.
Wow.
One problem that we ran into with Gene was that this guy, he had a attention deficit disorder.
Okay.
And that he would get going on something until he figured it out. And it would always be some, bright light insight. And then he wouldn't write it up.
Oh, no.
He'd move on to the next project. And it would sit there and languish. And that was the terrible thing. A lot of his great work never got published.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, this stuff on the Needles Fault Zone and the sliding model and all that stuff, he never published that.
Okay.
So, I picked up on it, and I ran with that bull. But we made sure that he got the credit for the nucleus of that idea.
Cool.
And I always felt good about that. And the same thing happened at Upheaval Dome. He recognized that the thing was an impact crater. He and another guy or two wrote an abstract for the Geological Society of America. They give the paper. No follow-up publication from Gene.
Oh.
He'd done it. He'd been there. He was on to something else. Really great stuff,
Wow.
I had one opportunity to give it back to him a little bit. There was a very curious dike that was about, 6 or 8 miles from the impact crater. And what this thing was, it was a dike of rocks that was up at the top of the Mesozoic section there. And it consisted of granules of rock that came up from below, like the Paradox Formation 2,000 feet below. You can find pieces of that limestone up here at the land surface.
Okay.
And it's a dike, just like the dikes we were talking about the other day that are volcanics coming up. Well, this was clastic rocks coming up.
Like being squeezed up like peanut butter between bread?
Yeah.
Okay.
And all of them were younger than the upper Paradox. And I got in there and I started looking at this thing and I thought, wait a minute. This stuff is really odd. There's no volcanics associated with it. It's
right.
Not volcanic. This thing happened without the need for going to the Earth's mantle to get the energy.
Right.
Where did the energy come from that caused this crack and all this stuff to come up?
Hmm.
And by now I'm learning something. And one thing that's coming along the pike now is fracking, You drill an oil well, you get into tight rocks that have a lot of oil in them, but it won't flow because there's no permeability. Well, what you do is you pump water or something down there, increase the pressure until it cracks the rocks, and then the oil will flow out and you can pump it out the well. That's the idea of fracking. That idea is floating around. And I'm thinking, this thing looks like a frack. It looks like a fracture that was formed by some pulse, and the material from the paradox flowed up it after it opened.
Oh, wow.
And it was driven by some fluid. And it didn't take any rocket scientist to go one step further and say, gee, upheaval dome impact is just 6 miles away.
Oh, wow.
When that thing came in, what it did is it compressed the land surface when it hit, right? It's coming in at 18 or 20,000 kilometers per second, so it's going to make a dent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It compresses the land surface, and it squeezes the aquifers that are underneath it. And one of those aquifers, or several of those aquifers, are the clastic layers in the paradox, and they got overpressured oil in them.
Okay.
And what they do is the compression causes that oil to get up to pressures that are high enough that they simply frack the overlying beds, crack it all the way land surface, and the stuff guards up the hole, up the crack.
Wow.
And that's what we got. So, you know, I mean, there's a good idea. So I went running down there one time and crawled along this damn crack for about a half a mile, and what do I find? I find dead oil in the cracks.
Oh, wow.
Came from the paradox. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. So I run this idea by Gene. I said, hey, Gene, you got a great idea here. Here's a little supplement to it. And he goes, oh, that's great. You know, he says, I want to work on the mathematics of that stuff and all that. So he fools with it for a while. And then he died.
Huh.
But anyway, before he died, thank God, I sent an article in on that, and we got it published, and it talks about this very unusual hydraulic fracture. This
cool.
Hydraulic fracture. And, I mean, this kind of thing is just the kind of thing you live for to be involved in because it was so off the wall.
Yes.
Anyway, that's enough of that.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Huh. All right, so let's go back. You've met Pete Perry, and Pete said, okay, you need to meet Dave May, and got you to meet May, and May said, need river trip, we got administrative use for that. Good luck. And I'm thinking, okay, in the Western Grand Canyon, you had air power, you had helicopter power, you had boot power, and you had vehicle power to drive around, you know, the roads and whatnot. In Canada, it's kind of similar. You're going to need air power and boot power and vehicle power.
Oh, yeah, we had everything. Same old.
Okay, and so take it from the top. Step one, did you like, first thing we need is aerial maps? Is that how you started with this?
Oh, we did it exactly the same way. They had just published a map of the entire park, a topographic map, just
okay.
Like they'd done in the Grand Canyon.
Ah.
And so we had that map available.
Okay.
Well, that was going to be our base map. Of course, that's the key to the thing. And now all we had to do is go out there and plot the geology on this map. So it was that type of the work was similar to what we did in the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
So George took the responsibility for the sedimentary rocks, and I took the responsibility for the structure, just
okay.
Like we did at the Grand Canyon.
All right.
And both of us, we worked together when we could, but a lot of the time we had to go up there independently because what he's looking at is not the geography I got to be in.
Okay.
And of course, I've got a couple of rafts, so I'm getting on the river. He didn't do any rafting in Cataract.
Okay.
But I did, and I had my graduate students down there, and I had a couple of them that did their master's theses down there.
Okay.
And one of them was this guy, Henry Richter. I've mentioned him from the Grand Canyon. He did a thesis that was primarily involved in locating springs and explaining stuff on the east side of the Colorado River, focused around Lockhart Basin. And he did some wonderful work down there that will become very important when we get into the rest of this project.
So where is Lockhart Basin?
Well, that's east of the Colorado River, and it's north of the confluence between the Colorado and the Green. And it's a basin that's about, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles in diameter. And it's a peculiar area because there's...
Well, wait a minute. Well, Lockhart Basin, it's kind of flat, but it has all these little hoodoos in it.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
Okay, well, what happened was the salt dissolved out from directly under Lockhart Basin, and the rocks fell in there about 1,000 feet or something like that, and So you got this basin, this sedimentary basin. And the rocks fell in there so full that actually there's a little dirt on top of them because they couldn't get out. And not only that, as the salt was dissolving, simultaneously, breccia pipes are working their way, sloping their way up through, and they come up all the way 2,000 feet from the Paradox Formation to the bottom of Lockhart Basin.
Oh, wow.
And this was dynamite. And one of them, in the middle of the basin, is unambiguous, right where the breccia crops out in the bottom of the canyon, is a big smear of salt that's precipitated on the floor of the canyon there. And what that represents is brine that's circulating from the top of the Paradox Formation 2,000 feet up that pipe, and it's discharging from the pipe into the little creek that goes by. And that creek is ephemeral, so it evaporates and leaves the salt slick there. No ambiguity what we got.
Huh.
Now, that's pretty damn exciting. And everybody's looking at breccia pipes as uranium ore deposits, because sometimes when the water comes up, it's carrying uranium, and you get a concentration of uranium in these pipes.
Yeah.
So finally, some guy from Moab gets our map. This happens after we're done. And he goes out there and puts a claim on this thing, and they drag a drill rig out there, and they drill into it. And, of course, that's another deal, just like the guys doing the dye tracing on the Kaibab Plateau. Somebody's out there testing my idea. Now this is where it gets a little dicey, right?
Well, isn't this in the national park? You can't just go out and put a drill rig in a national park.
Yeah, but see, Lockhart Basin is off the east side of the park.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a couple of miles from the boundary, see? So they drill the darn hole, and they hit the water level in a pipe right at the elevation of the bottom of that wash where the salt was coming out.
Okay.
And the deeper they drilled, the more permeable it got. It was perfect. I loved it. So, of course, I'd love it. But anyway, we're talking about a lot of professional excitement for me.
Okay.
You know, everything we've talked about is exciting. But this is really, you know, this is the kind of stuff you're really glad to get up in the morning to learn and see, you know.
Well, had you left Nebraska by this time?
Yeah, now I'm at the University of Wyoming, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got to the University of Wyoming in 74.
All right. So this is really exciting because you're thinking, all right, I'm going to be writing papers, and this is going to be pretty neat. Does this carry into excitement in the University of Wyoming, or is this excitement amongst the geologists of the world?
I'm really not too concerned about who is excited about it except myself.
Okay.
But this was a benefit to the university because, of course, I had graduate students from the university that were working on thesis down there.
Oh, got it. Excellent.
So,
okay.
And so they're getting something out of it,
yeah.
You know. And everybody's, in a moment, we'll see that everybody's got their eyes on Canyonlands.
Okay.
Because of the DOE looking at the salt as a possible repository for nuclear waste.
All right, now hang on. I'm going to hold DOE for just a minute. We're going to talk about that next time. But I want to try to go back and keep working on this mapping project. What do you remember about the project itself, getting boots on the ground, and where did you stay? Did they give you lodging?
No. We were in those days. I was living out of the back of a truck, or Canyonlands is great. It never rains out there, so you can sleep out there in a sleeping bag. It was just wonderful. All I do is come down there and do camping trips, and oftentimes George would drive up from Flagstaff, and we'd go out there and work together.
Okay.
And, it was just the same old deal. It was hike, figure out what you couldn't see from hiking, lease a plane, get up there and take some pictures and stuff like that. And I had fabulous flights up there. I used to fly out of the airport north of Moab, and I had a couple of really good ones. One was one day we went up to take pictures of Upheaval Dome.
Okay.
Got up there about, I don't know, 2,000 feet above the dome, and I got the most beautiful vertical photos of Upheaval Dome that were ever taken. I was just
nice.
There on a perfect day.
Wow.
And another time, well, we'll talk about this later. I'll tell you an anecdote with the DOE people. But anyway, this is what we did. It was the same as the Grand Canyon. If we couldn't get at something or we needed an overview, mm-hmm. then we'd go lease one of these planes.
Okay.
Now, the thing was, by now, the cost of planes is inflated on us.
Who?
When we were working out of Grand Canyon Village, believe it or not, we were renting these Cessna 172s for, or 182s $32 an hour.
Okay, wow.
Now we're up there paying about $38 or $40 an hour. It really hurting us.
Okay.
Anyway, yeah. We've been flying around. And then, as you'll find out, the DOE also flew us around once we got involved with them.
Okay. All right. And did you use helicopter work there?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. The DOE did the helicopter work.
Oh, but before the DOE got on site, did you use helicopter?
No.
Okay.
The Florida was $150 an hour.
Oh, well. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So we didn't need it. We didn't need that.
Okay. So the river can only get you, I mean, I'm thinking about the White Rim Sandstone coming down the Green Arm in Stillwater Canyon. You're not going to get above that. So, yeah. You know, I mean, it's just like this kind of hard sandstone that makes it with the softer stuff under it, so there's this overhang. Hiking up to that from the river is pretty tough.
Yeah, well, what we do is we hike up to the base of that.
Yep.
And get that part done. And then in Canyonlands on top of the White Rim, at least north of the confluence, there was a jeep road that went around there.
On both sides of the river there's roads. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and so you could get at it a little better. You know, it wasn't like the Grand Canyon where you couldn't drive in there. You know, there
right.
was a couple of these back roads. Now, these roads were horrible.
Huh.
And the one on the south side, on the east side.
On the Hanksville side. No, on the Island in the Sky side.
Yeah, no, on the other side of the Island in the Sky, the east side of the Colorado River.
Oh, okay. Oh, the Maze side?
Yeah, yeah. You come down there to the Maze, and then you go north to Lockhart Basin.
Got
that
it.
Road goes all the way back to Moab.
Ooh.
But it's a one-way trip.
Okay.
And the problem is that right in the middle, after you get north of Lockhart Basin, there's a slot that's just as wide as a carry-all truck.
Okay.
And it goes down at about 35 or 40 degrees
Ooh.
Over sand and rock, and it's a one-way trip. If you can't get that truck through there, there's no going back.
Yeah.
And this was a real dicey place to work. On the Island in the Sky District, there's a road that goes from the Moab side all the way around the Island in the Sky, around above the confluence, and back up and comes out at Mineral Bottom.
Right.
And that road, I don't know, that must be about 40 or 50 miles long. And that's a one-way trip for us, too, because we had to go from the east side to the west side on that road, because on the west side, you had to drive down a sand dune. And that was just put the truck in gear and fly into the sand and float down the hill. And you come out on some rocks and you can drive out of there.
Okay.
But you couldn't go the other way.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But anyway, that
All
was
right.
the access. But there's also some trails there.
Okay.
And you can
yep.
get in and out of the place, you know.
Okay.
But anyway, like you say, we could only go up from the river, you know, maybe 5-6 miles.
Hmm.
You weren't going to go 10 miles. And coming down from the top, okay, you can get at that however you can get at it.
And again, you must have been seeing just some really interesting country that not a lot of people get a chance to wander around in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and nobody's out there.
It was
wonderful.
That place got bulldozed pretty good in the 50s by the Iranian people that were looking in the Morrison Formation for uranium. You must have seen a bunch of that stuff as well.
Well, yeah, and the Chinle Formation. The Chinle Formation had uranium in it.
Okay.
And what they did, and this is cynical, but this is the way life is, what they did is the uranium miners actually bulldozed the road virtually the entire length of the, that shale unit.
Okay. Of the Chinle?
Yeah, the Chinle. They bulldozed the road almost the entire length of the Chinle outcrop through the entire Canyonlands National Park.
Wow.
And that included the access roads to get up to it, looking for uranium. Once they found that there was absolutely no commercial uranium there, then people got out of the way to let the park have the wreckage of it all.
Got it. Got it. Wow.
But nothing new.
Yeah.
Nothing new.
Yeah.
And, of course, nobody, they also did the same thing with oil. Wherever they thought they could drill, they drilled, and that oil was found before the park was designated.
Right.
So the oil wells are north of the park boundary.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, it's life is life. But anyway,
yeah.
When we were there, those roads were in a very advanced stage of being reclaimed,
okay,
in terms of just natural reclamation. But you could see them everywhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's still today. You get out and walk around a little bit. And you're like, oh, this looks like a Bull Wills track. Oh, there's an airfield here. Oh,
yeah.
Gee whiz! Look, there's a couple bits of rusted junk over here, and you know, you're like, well, oh, this
well,
is a, you know,
the same along the river. I'll tell you one anecdote about that. Around 1910 or so, there was a dome just south of Moab that looked real good along the river. And the oil guys got in there and thought, hey, this looks like a dome. We're in Saudi Arabia. We ought to drill the core of this thing, and we're going to be rich, right? So they floated in a barge, and they set up a drill rig right on the axis of the anticline, right on the side of the river. They were only 15 feet back from the water.
Yeah.
And they drilled this oil well down to the Paradox. And when they got to the Paradox has oil in it, and often that oil is very overpressured, which means that it'll go up the well all the way to the land surface.
Yeah.
And so what they did is they drilled into the thing, and they got a geyser of oil. And the oil came flying out of the hole, ran right down the side, and right into the Colorado River, and went all the way down to the Delta.
Yes, and I think, so Godfrey Sykes writes about a horrendous fish kill in his book, The Westerly Trend. And it's right about that time. And I'm like, could it be that it's this oil well pumping out all this oil? It was uncapped for months and spewed a huge amount of oil into the river day after day, day and night. And I wondered, was that Sykes' fish kill? I don't know.
Yeah, we'd have to correlate it. I tried running down newspapers in Moab and down in El Central California to see if I could find any mention of this stuff going by, and I didn't. But I wouldn't be surprised if that guy didn't find something.
I wonder. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a real good, you know, I mean, it's a great thing. And it's written up. It's in some of the guidebooks, the geologic guidebooks, a story about this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It is amazing history.
But so, anyway, that junk is still down there. You can go down there and see all the debris from that. Today, it's still
yeah,
there. You know?
Right
in the middle
big,
of the park.
Big wall of tamarisk trees, and you flap back in there, and there they are.
Yeah, but of course, you know, now the park is protecting it as a historic site.
Over 50 years old, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, garbage turns into a protected site after a little while.
Garbage turns into an interpretive center, yeah, absolutely right. Yeah. So how long did it take you guys to complete the map?
It took us a couple of years.
Okay.
And, you know, I was working up in Wyoming, same deal, looking at a lot of aerial photos. And when I had a vacation, I got out of Canyonlands and do the field work.
Okay.
And
were you giving your material to George? Was George the guy with the repeatographs?
He's doing
drawing it out.
Thing.
Okay.
And it's the same process.
Okay.
And that was it. But the nice thing about Canyonlands was I could get to it in the winter.
Oh.
Unlike the Grand Canyon, so I got down there in some cool weather. I love the place.
Nice.
But one thing I had one anecdote that just is typical of Canyonlands. We would get down there in the summer to do our river trips because that's when I had more time.
Okay.
And one time a group of us were going down a canyon. We had my two Avons. And we were above the rapids, way above them, you know, like 15 miles above. We were looking for a place to camp, and it was 110 degrees. It was awful. And what we had were, in those days, the tamarisks were coming in, but they hadn't taken over every square inch of the beach.
Okay.
And so where we were, the only places to camp were these beautiful sand beaches that had a wall of tamarisk against the rock. And we're going along, and here's this beautiful beach, and there's the Tammies. And nobody's thinking anything about this, and we decide that this is going to be where we're going to stay tonight. We pull the two rafts over. We get out on a beach, and we walk up halfway to the beach, and this black cloud comes out of the tamarisk.
Ooh.
Well, what that is mosquitoes.
Yeah.
And, I mean, they ate us alive. And there we are. We're sitting on this beach. It's 110. And we got nowhere else to go. There's nothing. No islands, nothing around here. So we're sitting there like sitting ducks. And finally, we gathered up firewood and built a big fire and created a lot of smoke. And the lousy mosquitoes went away. And we sat there in 110 degrees hovering around this fire.
Fire. Oh, my gosh.
Have you been there? It was awful.
Yeah, it's like just you throw up your tent. You huddle in the dang thing, baking. You're in your tent baking, but at least you have a little mosquito sort of mosquito-less zone, not mosquito-free, because there's only one or two in your tent. It came in with you until you get rid of them.
Well, one thing was when we first started working in Canyonlands, there were tamarisks around, but we were there before they took the place over.
Interesting.
And so beaches were everywhere. Huh. It was heaven.
Wow.
But
wow.
Those days change quickly.
Yeah, and that's the same in Grand Canyon as well. After Grand Canyon Dam.
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay. Well, that gives you kind of a warm up for Canyonlands.
It does, and maybe next time think about this between now and then, and we might explore your Canyonlands mapping project a little more before the DOE shows up, and then it'll be DOE.
Yeah, well, we're ready for the DOE.
Okay. All right. Anything else you want to add to the material we've just covered?
No, we're doing good.
All right, very good. Well, this will then conclude part 8 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Peter Huntoon. Today is Tuesday, October 3rd, 2023. My name is Tom Martin. Peter, thank you so very much.
Okay.